I represent Mr. Reed, and this case involved a whole lot of complex different issues.
Did you want to save any time for rebuttal, sir?
Yes, what's the maximum?
You can reserve 14 minutes, but...
No, I'll reserve 7, please.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. So, but there's one issue in here that's already been decided that sort of resolves the complaints that we have. The Supreme Court decided that...
I'm going to stop the clock here just to ask a general question. I'm going to ask the question both of you and Ms. Johnson. There's a whole lot of discussion in this case about standing and you know, whether or not he has standing to object to the cell tower information that was received and the like. And as I was going through the case, a threshold question of standing came up in that it appears from the facts, and both of you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the cell phone that was used in this particular case was not even the defendant's cell phone. It wasn't registered. The number was not registered to him. Do we need to make a threshold determination, not us, but does a trial court need to make a threshold determination in this case whether or not the defendant, your client, has the ability based upon standing to object to all of this because the phone was not really registered in his name?
I don't think so, and they didn't address that issue, and the issue of standing in relationship to the party order was not raised in the lower court. The only standing issue in the lower court which came up sua sponte from the court had to do with the subpoena duces tecum under Rule 3812.
Okay, let me stop you, Ms. Johnson. What would be your position there?
Actually,
I'm sorry.
Victoria Johnson. My position would be that, yes, he does have to establish that. He has some control over the phone piece.
Typically, and again, I'm not running the clock, we're just trying to sort through this, and Judge Beals and Judge O'Brien and I have discussed this somewhat. Standing is usually determined based upon a case-by-case, fact-by-fact basis, and this court typically does not get into fact-finding determinations. That's left, obviously, to a trial court. Should we send this case back to the trial court for a determination factually as to whether or not the defendant has predicate standing, and that's what I'm going to call it here?
If standing is an issue in the context of a court's decision, I would suggest to Your Honor that it was waived by the Commonwealth by not raising it. I'm under the principle of Green Law by the U.S. Supreme Court, which involved a circuit decision on a sentencing issue where the defendant took the issue up. The government did not take any issue up. I think it was the Sixth Circuit decided that the defendant could have gotten a greater sentence, and had the government appealed, would have gotten a greater sentence, and denied the defendant's appeal. The Supreme Court said the United States, not having chosen to raise the issue, the Court of Appeals was bound by the issues raised by the parties under the principle of party presentation. I don't have a cite to Green Law, the U.S. Supreme Court case, I can provide it.
Let me switch to here for Attorney General just for a moment. I'll come back.
Yes, sir.
Yes, ma'am. What's
Your Honor, the Commonwealth does not have to preserve issues that the defendant is appealing. There's always the right decision for the wrong reason. The Commonwealth can rely upon. I don't think you need to send it back because I think under even if you assume that he has standing as a person using the phone, I don't think he's established that the record should have been suppressed.
In that regard, may I address that, Your Honor, please?
Just a moment.
Yes, sir.
I think we should just go on the original. All right, your time has started.
All right. if standing is an issue that the court feels needs to be addressed, and there is no factual record on it, then it would need to be remanded. However, under the subpoena duces tecum issue, there is and a basis to exclude the evidence that was presented at trial. On page 16 of the Commonwealth's brief, they quote the trial judge in her determination that Mr. Reed was guilty. And in her determination where she says it's a circumstantial case, she says that she needs corroboration of Officer Gregory's testimony, and she uses the cell phone records that were provided by Mr. Polanski of Verizon in New Jersey and the charts that were developed from his evidence to create this corroboration for her finding of determination of guilt. And she's the one who heard the witnesses, and she's the one who was there in the room and said, I need corroboration, and here it is. And Mr. Polanski from Verizon of New Jersey said he was there because he was subpoenaed. In Yelp, the Supreme Court said circuit courts in Virginia may not subpoena non-parties who are foreigners from foreign jurisdictions and order them to come to Virginia.
But Mr. Miller, that was the Yelp case, and that was a civil case. This subpoena due to state was under 19270.3, which provides...
This was not a 19.2. This was a 3A12 subpoena, and they did not use 272 or any of the authorizations for witnesses in foreign jurisdictions in this case. They only used a 3A12 subpoena, and if you look on the back of it, I think it's on page 7 in the appendix, it says serve Verizon of New Jersey, and if you look at subsection C of 3A12, it says that the subpoenas may be served anywhere in the Commonwealth. So in Yelp, under 4:9A, there was no provision about where it could be served, and the Supreme Court said the General Assembly did not authorize courts to serve those kinds of subpoenas outside of Virginia. In 3A12C, they authorized it to be served only in Virginia. And so this is a 3A12 subpoena, and they didn't use the interstate compact of witnesses from foreign jurisdictions. Just like in the Yelp case, and in this case, they didn't even serve it on a registered agent like they did in Yelp. In Yelp, they served it on a Virginia agent. In this case, they served it by fax in New Jersey.
Isn't that how they requested it? The recipient of the subpoena asked for it to be faxed?
Well, I don't know that they did or they didn't. That's what somebody said. But the point of it is, the Virginia Circuit Court doesn't have authority to order a foreign non-party to produce things. And Mr. Reed has a right, which if you look at in Gibbs, which we cited, I think, on page 13 of our reply brief, and on page 300 of, 16 DA Act in that case, they cite to Fisher. All of the cases dealing with 3A12 motions to quash are by parties. And why is that? Because materiality is an issue. And if you look at the annotations to 3A12 in Mickey and everywhere else, they address materiality. Now, who's going to address materiality? Is the mechanic in New Jersey going to address materiality? No. But the parties are. And so the Commonwealth brings motions like in Gibbs and in Fisher to quash subpoenas because it's not material or for other reasons related to it. That's why the parties are mandated to get notice for a 3A12 subpoena, and the applicant is mandated to give an affidavit that is material, and the reason you get notice is so that all of those cases, and there are lots of them on materiality raised by the defendants and prosecutors, whether or not the subpoena should issue or not issue, whether it should be quashed. And so he has standing to quash the subpoena. The circuit court said he didn't, but the circuit court raised that sua sponte. It wasn't raised by the Commonwealth, and I wasn't sitting there with a case like Gibbs or Fisher or the others where that happens. In addition to which, Yelp was very clear, not just in the civil context, but in the general context of authority of circuit courts of the Commonwealth of Virginia, when it says that the General Assembly's authorization does not confer upon Virginia courts subpoena power over non-resident non-parties, period. And that's at page 434 of the Yelp decision.
But was Yelp doing business in the Commonwealth of Virginia?
Yelp was doing business in the Commonwealth of Virginia and had a registered agent in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and they said that's really good for long-arm statute civil litigation. But they said subpoena power is completely different than long-arm contacts for purposes of suing somebody for acts they commit here. They said that the subpoena power of a corporation that is not a party to a lawsuit is not based on conduct except subjects the non-resident to the power of the state courts, which is what Your Honor is addressing, because a non-party who is a non-resident is based on the authority of the court to compel a person to appear, and they talk about the fact that the sovereign over that non-party, non-resident is the one that orders them to appear in court. And they cite Colorado, Alabama, Louisiana, Massachusetts, and Oklahoma with favor on pages 434 and 435 of that decision as saying that you can't order a non-resident, non-party to appear because you don't have jurisdiction over them, you don't have sovereignty over them, which is why in that case they have the Uniform Deposition Act, where the foreign sovereign exercises authority over their citizen, not Virginia courts. They do it at a Virginia court request. In Virginia, you've got 19.2272, which is the Witness in Foreign Jurisdictions Act. And what happens? The circuit court goes, I've got a case, I'm certifying that there's a controversy, and then the court in the foreign jurisdiction brings its citizen before it, and the court in the foreign jurisdiction exercises its sovereignty over its citizen, and says under the act, okay, you have to come. Since the Civil War, we enacted this thing called the 14th Amendment, which is a due process right. And the due process right means that a defendant in a criminal case is entitled to and is due the process authorized by law. And in Yelp, it was a civil case. That's the way it got before the court. But the point is that it was the court not having power outside of its jurisdictional authority, which is the Commonwealth of Virginia, and they don't. The whole concept of federalism is based on the states have sovereignty within their borders, and there's a national government. That's why you got the Uniform Deposition from Foreign Jurisdictions Act, the Witnesses from Foreign Jurisdictions Act, so that a state can use the act and get the sovereign court over the entity to have that person appear. And if that's followed in this case, then the subpoena just is taken, goes out. Mr. Polanski was only there for that reason, according to his testimony. And if that goes out, then the evidence goes out.
Okay, so you have about 6:30 left on your rebuttal, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So I'm done. But it's been suggested by your opponent colleague that the methodology that's been made available by statute under 19.2-270 was not used to get Verizon's participation in the case. What would be your response to that?
He has no standing to object to that. That is merely subpoena process. Verizon has a right to say to the to the states that it works with, because it is covered as a foreign company under 19.2-70.3, and that is clearly what the subpoena was entered under. It has a right to say, for its own convenience, for its own business reasons, we don't want to be served 50 different times when we have subpoenas in various states. We want it to go to one centralized place so we can have one unit of our organization responding to those subpoenas. For their own business reasons, they're permitted to do that. It can be waived. Personal jurisdiction can be waived.
And your position is that the defendant did not have standing because these are Verizon's records, and so therefore the defendant does not have the ability to object to the subpoenaing of Verizon's records. But doesn't the defendant enjoy some sort of derivative right? In other words, the information that is being turned over relates to the defendant's arguable private information. Doesn't the defendant have some sort of derivative standing to contest this in the context of a subpoena?
No, he's voluntarily shared that information with a third party. His standing to contest the subpoena and quash the subpoena comes under materiality. That's where his standing lies, not in objecting to the process between the Commonwealth and Verizon, but objecting to the scope and materiality of the subpoena. And that's what he did in the trial court. And the trial court did indeed limit the scope of the subpoena to, I believe he said, 2 days on either side of July 18, 2012. So that was his opportunity to quash the subpoena, and he was somewhat successful in that it was limited in scope. Now, the first issue addressing the various assignments and errors seems to be the out-of-state issue. Did the Commonwealth and the trial court have authority to compel Verizon, and can the defendant object to that? And as I said, the statutory authority for that comes in 19.2.70.3, which expressly provides for foreign corporations doing business in the Commonwealth to turn over.
So your argument is it doesn't matter whether it was in New Jersey or California or Virginia, or let's take it a little farther, Nassau. If they're operating, a foreign corporation operating and doing business in Virginia, and they designate that location, they've submitted themselves to the subpoena powers of the Commonwealth there.
Yes, and I would note that Yelp isn't really applicable in this case, because Yelp is about enforcement. When Yelp itself objected to the subpoenas. Verizon did not object to the subpoenas in this case. Yelp, in that case, was objecting to the subpoenas and objecting to being held in contempt for not complying with the subpoenas. It's a very different circumstance than a third party, the defendant, trying to put himself.
So Yelp, in your view, Yelp isn't a standing case, it's a compliance case.
Yes. Now, there has also been some conflating in this case of personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction. Clearly, the court had subject matter jurisdiction because this case involved felonies committed in Virginia. And the defendant simply can't object to the service or the power of the state. He has no interest in the process of how Verizon chooses to do business and how they choose to accept the subpoenas and the orders. It's somewhat like a consent to search. He's voluntarily shared his information with Verizon. He could voluntarily share a location with another person, and they could consent to that search, but he wouldn't have standing to object to their consent if their consent was valid. Again, he could only object to the materiality of the subpoena. And here is a phone number used at the time of the crime, during the crime, to communicate with one of the other people with whom he was selling the cocaine. It was linked to the defendant by the name under which the number was stored in Payne's phone, and also the detective who'd been working with the defendant as a CI, who knew how to contact him at that number. So the defendant was identified as being a principal in a crime occurring on July 18, 2012, and using his phone in that crime. Clearly the records for that date were material. The other issue is whether he had some sort of right to privacy, and nothing the defendant cites gives him an absolute right to privacy in the information he shares with Verizon.
Because I understand it, that the question in this case doesn't necessarily relate to the substance of the information that was retrieved, but rather the defendant's movements based upon the cell tower locations. Am I misunderstanding
well,
things?
Well, I think the defendant argues a lot about GPS locations. Mm-hmm. If you would want to target order, ask for GPS locations. And since then, 19.270.3 has been
promulgated,
revised to make a special area for GPS locations. However, his GPS locations and his cell tower locations are completely different things. The GPS location is where he is moving with his phone. The cell tower location is what his phone is pinging off of, what Verizon product essentially is tower. The cell phone is interacting with it at any given time. And they're not the same thing. That is historical cell phone data that's recovered. And that's not the same as GPS locations. GPS locations are, I would suggest, completely irrelevant to this case because they were not admitted, and there seems to be no further information that was obtained from them that was used against Mr. Reed in any way the only information was essentially the wedges of area, whose phone was hanging off of, and where Mr. Payne's phone was hanging off of, and how those interacted at the time of the crime. Because, of course, Mr. Reed had given alibi notice and was going to be arguing alibi that he was somewhere else and not taking part in this crime. The defendant wants the Electronic Communication Privacy Act to give him more privacy than the third-party rule does. However, the Electronic Communication Privacy Act specifically allows disclosure if there is an articulated and specific showing. And that's what was here. In fact, the court found the probable cause was met when issuing the original ex parte order and then the subpoena to be taken. Simply put, the defendant had no right to privacy that was improperly violated. The subpoena was proper in this case, and the evidence was properly admitted. Are there any further questions?
How do you respond to Mr. Miller's point earlier that the Commonwealth really did not argue or raise the issue of standing below?
Once again, the issue, you mean the issue of standing in particular regarding whose phone it was?
I think that was...
Yeah, we call it predicate point. Standing.
Right, yeah. I think that was the point he was making.
Well, once again, the issue is whether the Commonwealth is somehow barred from that under the right reason, right decision, wrong reason, which I don't think it is. I also don't think you are required to rule on that to affirm this decision. The defendant actually is the one who raised that maybe it wasn't his phone because he was using a phone registered to someone else. But there's no question under the Commonwealth's evidence that the Commonwealth believed he was using that phone on the relevant date. I would argue that perhaps in other cases he would have to essentially admit to it being his phone that he was using in order to have standing to object to it. In this case, he's already been convicted, and I think all the evidence points to that it was in fact his phone. I really think the only reason it causes problems for him is because he suggested that perhaps it wasn't his phone. Commonwealth's position was that was another bit of evidence against him if he was using a phone registered to someone else as though he had something to hide. So I don't think it's actually necessary. It's the same way as if you search a car and there's no problem searching the car, it doesn't matter who's registered to at this level. All
right. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you. So now we got 6:30 left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
In the first instance, there is no case that limits a party's objection to a subpoena duces statement of materiality, and that's never been decided or held by any court. You have a right to object for whatever reason if you're a party. That's a common one. It's done, but there's no case, which is why the Attorney General's office didn't cite a case, saying that there's such a limit. And under Shaughnessy, which we cited in our reply brief, and under Service versus Dulles, a citizen has a right to demand that a government entity making a decision about them follow the applicable law. In a service, an employee couldn't be fired unless the person making a decision about firing them, I said fired, I meant fired, followed the law that applied to the decision. In Shaughnessy, it was a deportation case. There was a board that had the authority, same as the court, to make a determination. They didn't follow the law, and because they didn't follow the law, the individual couldn't be deported, the case had to go back, and they were ordered to follow the law, which is why Mr. Reed has a right to see that the court, in this case, follows the law. And it's very clear in the Yelp case that the General Assembly's authorization of the exercise of personal jurisdiction over non-resident defendants does not confer upon Virginia courts subpoena power over non-resident, non-parties, period. If this court says that the Virginia Circuit Court can issue a subpoena to a non-resident, non-party, and the individual on trial has no right to complain, then that means there are no rules. So, and they were there, they said, because of the subpoena.
Yeah, wouldn't really be no rules. It would be maybe limited rules in the context of a criminal case. For instance, if the defendant believed that the information that was turned over by an out-of-state corporation violated some contractual right that he had or whatever, he could sue him civilly and get some sort of remedy.
Here, the testimony from Walensky is, I'm only here because there's a subpoena ordering me to be here. And Mr. Reed has a right to see that the court doesn't order somebody to come to court, which is why he said he was there. That's his testimony. It's in the record at appendix page 422.
What is the ultimate implication, if you take this your argument to its logical extension, if you say that foreign corporations doing business in Virginia, if they choose to have the location of where such a subpoena would go in another city outside of Virginia, isn't your argument taking to its logical conclusion that excludes them from the subpoena powers of the Commonwealth?
In this case, we don't know where they wanted it. We know that it says on page 7 that it's to be served in New Jersey. And we know that Virginia can't order them, no matter where they serve it, to be here. Now, if Virginia contacts Verizon and says, we have this case, we want you to give us this information, and they say, fine, we'll do it. Okay, fine. Voluntary, the person voluntarily comes, that's their business, we can't complain. But the court used this process and ordered somebody to be here. And that's the only reason the person was here, because they were ordered, and the court didn't have authority to order them. And so that's where the law is.
But taking your argument to its logical conclusion, following up on Judge Beal's question, is that if you're saying that they can't make them come, theoretically, can't they just refuse to show up and deal with the circumstances and consequences associated with that?
That they're a third non-party out there on their own, making their own decisions. Mm-hmm. The parties to a lawsuit have a right to see that the courts follow the rules. There's a process that's real simple to get them here. And what happened here was the court ordered somebody to come. He obeyed the order because he believed he had to, because he said, I'm here pursuant to the subpoena, which is an order. And Mr. Reed has a right to complain when a court issues an order and has somebody come to court, which the Supreme Court of Virginia says it is not authorized to do.
Well, let me follow up on that, because can you clarify for me his testimony that, well, I'm here because of this subpoena. Does that equate to, I wouldn't be here, I would not have cooperated if I didn't have this subpoena? Because that's an implication for Verizon that is a pretty big one.
Well, here's the situation we have, Your Honor. Would you have come if you were not subpoenaed? Answer, I would not have. That answers your question. It's like the police didn't get a search warrant. They broke down the door, they entered the guy's house, and they took out 1,000 pounds of cocaine. Did they have enough evidence to get a search warrant? They had a videotape of the guy bragging on his front door, behind that curtain is 1,000 pounds of cocaine. Did they give it to a judge to get authority? No. Were there any exigent circumstances in that case, hypothetically? No, because you can't flush 1,000 pounds of cocaine, and they could go in and secure the place. But they didn't get a warrant, and they're obligated to get a warrant. If they could have, that's one thing, but they didn't. Here, they could have gotten it legally, but they got it in a way that's not authorized. And he said, I would not have. That's his answer to your question. So it's not whether or not they can do it lawfully. The question is, did they do it lawfully? And in this case, they didn't. And so since they chose not to, and they had easily available means to, they could have. One last point, if I may. The Graham case, which is now, was argued March 23rd on bond, Fourth Circuit, is dealing with expectation of privacy in records. And in it, they talk about the Jones case, where five justices, Alito, Breyer, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor, in Alito's concurrence, and Kagan in a separate concurrence, all agreed that where you go, 24/7, which is location data, whether it's GPS or historic, it's location data. And the Fourth Circuit said, we don't see a difference between location data and historic and following you around in real time. Implicates privacy rights because people don't know what the companies are doing with all of this kind of stuff, and that the American people aren't prepared to accept an invasion of privacy where you
How do you respond, though, to the Attorney General's argument that that's not what we really have here? We have not GPS, but what's cell tower it's being pinged off of at the moment?
Well, GPS works through the cell towers. That's how it happens. It works the same way. And that's why...
But it doesn't take you to the same exact location as GPS would, right?
It gets the same thing, and GPS works off of those kinds of triangles.
I mean, you know why I'm asking this, because the Jones case obviously is very focused on GPS.
And it's very focused on location data, which is why the Fourth Circuit on page 31 of the Graham panel decision said that they don't see a distinction between historic and real time. Now, real time on a 19270.3 C and K requires a search warrant, not just a probable cause or a search warrant. But they don't see the distinction, and the distinction in the five justices who are still on the court, so if it's be 5-3, if it's a new justice, it'd be 5-4, they look at location data, and they use the language location data, because location data is where are you, and the concern was, did he go to the psychiatrist? Did he go to a whorehouse? Did he go to church? Did he go see some kind of doctor? That's the same data, whether it's location data historically retrieved by electronic means, by putting the information together like Mr. Polanski did, or is it real time following you around in which you collect the data, but you do it under different electronic means? It's all the same thing.
Okay,
so
we can...
there is a privacy interest, and the District of Maryland and 2011, an application for oral authorizing disclosure found a reasonable expectation of privacy. The Eastern District of New York, in an order authorizing release of historic cell site information, did the same thing. New Jersey did in CSLI cases, which are the cell tower locations, in State versus Earl, Tracy versus State out of Florida in 2014, the same thing. And Commonwealth versus Augustine from Massachusetts in 2014 also dealt with cell tower information historically. So there's a trend dealing with that, and I can't tell you because I haven't got my forecast to bring on what the Fourth Circuit's going to do on bond, but if they follow the panel opinion and where many courts are going in the country, then they're going to find consistent with the majority opinion of the Supreme Court and Jones that there's an expectation of privacy.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you very much for your time.
We'll come down and greet counsel in the Smear case. Yes, sir. Would you want to go on?